Thomas Kilroy's new play, The Madam Macadam Travelling Theatre. The play tells the story of an English travelling theatre company which gets stranded in an Irish town during the Second World War. Thirrin Evrehan went to Derry for the opening night, and before the performance she spoke to the playwright Thomas Kilroy.
It's the same period as Double Cross, but it's an entirely different kind of show. It's intended for the most part to be comic or farcical. Whether it is or not is another matter. But it's different to that extent. It's also different in that it's a very kind of... I wanted to write a kind of a baggy, loose kind of play with lots of things happening on the stage, and I've never quite attempted anything like that before. You know, most of the things I've done have been kind of tight and controlled, and this time I just threw caution to the winds, as it were. Maybe a bit too much to the winds, but that's what I was striving for, you know, kind of a loose storytelling play which would be kind of immediately accessible at some level, surface level, to everybody, you know.
Why did you want it to be immediately accessible to everybody?
Well, I felt that I was trying to do something different for myself, and I also wanted to try and see if, in fact, if I could deal with kind of serious subjects under the skin of the comedy, you know. It's really a play about costuming and about putting on clothes and what happens to people when they put on costume, whether they're in the LDF or whether they're on the stage or whether it's a sergeant of the guards, you know. It's there is a strange kind of language that people develop when through what they wear, and it can be funny, it can be mysterious, it can be very dangerous.
This idea of writing what you say is essentially a comic play with deeper undertones, is it difficult to tread that dividing line? Does that present a very big challenge for you as a playwright?
Yes, it does. It's a difficult thing to do in the sense that you're not consciously doing it. You know what I mean is you're seeing the thing comically, and the whole thing comes through as comedy, but you're at the same time aware of the fact that you're doing something else, you know. It's not a conscious kind of mating or welding of the two together. It has to be kind of one, you know. It has to come organically.
Am I right in thinking that not many contemporary Irish playwrights have dealt in their work with Ireland during the Second World War and Ireland's neutrality during that time? I mean, was that something that you wanted to write about, that you've thought about?
Well, I don't know. I can't think immediately of another play set in that period. I don't think I was consciously trying to fill a gap that was there in the drama, but it's a period that fascinates me. It's a period that I think was a kind of a crucible of many, many different things in this country. I think, for instance, the isolation there immediately created the next decade and made Ireland even more isolated than would have been. And it's only very recently that has been cast off, you know, so that it's a period that the extreme isolation was quite extraordinary, you know, that you had a sense of another, total other world out there, which was not impinging at all on Ireland. And I think that growing up in that meant that, in a sense, your childhood was in a kind of preserve, you know, it was in a kind of a barricaded situation or whatever. And you see, for me, the theatre in the play is a kind of a comic invasion.
Do we have a good house? Are we packing them in? Do you know, I believe these people adore the theatre. Never played before such splendid audiences in my life. Never. Promise.
You are quite remarkable.
Thank you.
You know perfectly well I do not intend that as a compliment.
Mumsy, please, don't be cross with me. Not now, not before curtain. Shan't be able to get any lines.
You've been saying the same thing nightly for 25 years. Splendid audiences indeed.
Well, one must say the same thing nightly. Otherwise, one is unable to go on.
I blame myself. I have simply lost control over everything.
Nonsense, darling. Things have been infinitely worse in days gone by. By God, we've been through every conceivable kind of mishap, you and I. What more can happen to us?
You actually do believe that, don't you? That things get better?
But of course.
Whereas the truth is that something quite dreadful has been wearing us down for years now. We seem to be dwindling. It is rather like a wasting sickness. Soon there will be nothing left of us.
I simply will not allow you to speak like that. Won't, won't, won't.
I have this sense of imminent collapse, while at the same time the prospect of great illumination. Very odd.
Illumination. Absolutely. Whatever it may be, let us rise to the challenge.
Oh.
Oh, for heaven's sake, we still perform, don't we? People still come to see us. Why worry about anything else? We do not starve. Oh, mind you, we'd better find some petrol jolly soon. I will make inquiries among the natives.
How did Jim Nolan come to be chosen as the director for the play?
Well, Jim and I have had an association for some years now. He did what I thought was a wonderful revival of another play of mine, Talbot's Fox, with Red Kettle. And I had seen most of the Red Kettle work. And I love younger companies, and I love involvement with them. So that it was a very natural thing that I was drawn to him for that reason. I also had shown him the play, kind of at an early stage, and he was hugely enthusiastic and understanding of what I was trying to do, so that, you know, when the thing with the court went out of existence, I thought of him straight away.
So what's it like for director Jim Nolan, moving from the intimate theatre in Garter Lane in Waterford, where he did his last production, to the vastness of Derry's Guildhall? Does mounting this production present many technical problems?
Not so much the translation from Garter Lane to the Guildhall. I mean, certainly the Guildhall presents its own technical problems, but there are many of those in Garter Lane as well. Most of the technical problems in this show are really related to the set itself, where a truck, for instance, needs to be moved off stage at the end of the play. Believe me, there are lots of stories I can tell you about that, but that's for another time. So those sort of problems, which were actually inherent to the play itself, certainly caused us a lot of grief in the last few weeks, but hopefully they're all ironed out at this stage.
What's it like, though? I mean, the last show you directed, and indeed with fantastic critical acclaim and success, was Bent for Red Kettle in Waterford. To come from being identified with a group in your own city and all of that, to find yourself here now with a company like Fielder that has a certain kind of reputation, and in a city which I presume you haven't worked in before, has that been a little bit difficult or...?
Traumatic, I think, is the word. Traumatic. The biggest difficulty for me was not so much leaving Red Kettle to come to Field Day. I'm very much aware, obviously, of the reputation that the company has, and it's, of course, extremely well deserved. For me, it was actually working with working on a new play with the writer. The sort of pressure that brings to bear was something that I hadn't experienced before. You know, all of the plays that I had directed were revivals of productions where the writer wasn't a presence in the room, and Tom has been hugely supportive in that regard. I mean, he's, as you know, one of the country's leading writers, and it's been such a privilege that sort of privilege has been has far outweighed the inevitable pressures that having the writer in the room working on a new play with you bring to bear in the rehearsal room, you know.
And yet you must feel to a certain extent that that directorial autonomy is slightly watered down.
Yeah, it's been very much. I mean, the actors, the history of this production is very much, in terms of my relationship with Tom, a collaborative one. He always knew when to leave, and he knew when to be around. And really, the sort of nervousness that directors have about writers, while we can quite understand them, if you open yourself out to that process and you've got somebody or people who trust each other, it can only be rewarding, even if it is at times painfully difficult, you know.
I was here for the full rehearsal period, and I think it's the first time I've ever done this. Usually what I do is I attend for the first week and go away and let them say what they want to about me behind my back, and then I come back in at the kind of the last week when I can kind of do some help in on particular, very specific kind of problems. I stayed through this time, and very largely because Jim wanted me to stay, and I also was curious to have the experience, and but I think actually an author's presence does have an inhibiting effect, you know, and I feel that might have happened in some of the rehearsals that we had, although everybody was very generous to me, you know. But still, I think that maybe the ideal situation is in fact to allow space when the thing can be put together in your absence.
You mentioned the slight technical awkwardness of getting a truck off the stage at the end of the show. That's all very well in a large place like the Guildhall, but this is a touring production which is going to 18 locations around Ireland, then the Dublin Theatre Festival, then the Royal Court in London. What are you going to do with the truck, not to mention the dog? I hear there's a dog in this show as well.
That's right. Well, Lightning Lily is being well taken care of, so she'll be okay. Inevitably, there are going to be venues around the country, some of the smaller ones, where physically the truck won't go off. But one always has the recourse of theatre itself, so that something is suggested rather than stated, you know, which sounds great now, but let's see if it works in Claire Morris.
I'm sure the director didn't thank you for casting a greyhound in this play along with all the... Well, you didn't do the casting, but the writing of a greyhound into this play. Yeah. What possessed you to do this? Have you a particular interest in the matter of greyhounds?
Well, my father kept greyhounds. And when we grew up, greyhounds were kind of part of the household. So that I had a kind of a certain nostalgia for them. I mean, I was never interested in greyhound racing myself or anything like that. I was interested in a particular story, which is a story out of my childhood, of a group of local characters who painted a greyhound and did a switch at the dog track. And it seemed to me to be a wonderful theatrical metaphor of performance and of makeup, and also this notion that deception, you know, that you're conning people, that is very similar to actually what happens in a theatre. So that I wanted to bring the two together and involve an actor in the con trick, and that's the basis of where it came from.
Poor Dixie. That poor whore Dixie.
She's dead and buried, Sergeant.
I'll miss that bitch, Chamberlain. She's lying out there in the backyard, God rest her.
That one's gone, this one's here. Dixie, resurrected, brought back to life by human handiwork and the fortunate discovery of a near lookalike below my own litter. Am I right or am I wrong, Dr. Watson?
Mashed to a T. Tell us, Chamberlain, how did you get the colours right?
Now, Sergeant, you're the law around here and I'm the criminal. It'd be better for you and it'd be better for me and it'd be better for that poor gom slipper there if I said no more. But I say this, The basic ingredients is axle grease and black lead.
Lord save us. And will it ever come off again?
Oh, I can tell you one thing. It won't come off while she's doing 30-25 round Clonmel track.
John Keyes, theatre critic of Fortnight magazine. We're here in the Guildhall after the opening performance of the Madame McAdam Travelling Theatre. What was your overall impression? Did you have high expectations of this?
I had high expectations because the kind of theatre it was supposed to be about, I'm very familiar with. I had also high expectations because it was a play by Thomas Kilroy, and that always arises high expectations. I have to say, on the whole, in spite of what I thought was a fine production with some superb performances, the expectations weren't realised. I thought the play wasn't as good as it should have been. I thought it lacked a kind of cohesive core. And I thought it raised all sorts of interesting speculations about the nature of art, the nature of truth, illusion versus reality, which were touched on and somehow lost, so that at the end I began doubting a thesis which, in fact, I had fully supported.
Mm. The play is supposed to be about a travelling English theatre company which gets stuck in some part of rural Ireland and has run out of petrol during World War II. But, of course, it seems to be about an awful lot more than that. Is that part of the problem?
I think it is part of the problem. I think Thomas Kilroy's imagination is so rich, so varied, and his use of language is so extraordinarily subtle that the ideas that he touched on and subsequently didn't develop left one feeling quite unsatisfied and saying, well, now, what is the play about? Is it a metaphor, for example, for the of the English in Ireland? Is it really what we're told in the publicity handouts about, that it's to seek truth through illusion and by the contrast of the one finding the other? But I couldn't find a satisfactory answer to any of these questions. So many of the characters came up, gave us little bits of autobiography, which we didn't know whether they were true or whether they weren't true. Now, this, in effect, doesn't matter if at the end we're going to come to a deeper truth then. But ultimately, I was so confused by some of the things that were happening that in the end I thought, I don't know what's true. I don't know what the kind of truth that Kilroy is writing about. And until I do know that, I don't know how good a play this is. I think that, in fact, things were underlined too much. We had the business of the soldiers at the beginning in uniform. We then had the actors in their daily clothes and then their costumes. We ultimately had the soldiers coming on, carrying the actors' costumes with them. And it seemed to me that that one said, well, yeah, I take the point that uniforms take village people and turn them into fascists, that costumes take rather bad actors and turn them into kinds of purveyors of a general truth. But at the end of the day, so what? You were left with the feeling, well, you've made this point, you made it in the first half, it was remade in the second half. There was a lot of repetition about the nature of art. You had the interesting, I think, spectacle of a company of very good actors playing a company of very bad actors to an Irish audience in the 1940s, and then removed once again a degree these good actors playing the bad actors playing in front of a 1980s Irish audience, so that you were in the realms of Pirandello and not sure where you were going to get out of there.
The self-same audience, the 1980s one, I mean, was pretty subdued, wasn't it?
I thought it was very subdued. I usually, when you go out into the interval, you discuss the play, you're hearing all sorts of opinions about it. Even during the play, although there were tremendously good dramatic moments when the audience was very silent and very attentive, I didn't get that all over feeling. This is a world premiere of a new play by Fielday, which will tour Ireland, go to England, tell England something about us. And, you know, I didn't get the feeling that this audience was part of this truth discovering mission.
And some of the comedy seemed to kind of filter up into the air somewhat, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I think that, you see, many of the things that I find amusing, simply having played in the fit-ups in Ireland, I can't see that a 1980s audience would have any relevance to this at all. I mean, the comedy was actors' comedy, and actors love that kind of comedy.
And it was very funny in places.
Very funny, as again, Kilroy's plays always are. Mm. The lines were good. Some of the characters were good. The character, I thought, played by Kevin Flood, who gave a splendid performance, I thought this was a good character, and we learned a great deal about him. But ultimately, I didn't really learn very much about what I thought Thomas Kilroy was trying to do. Mm. Ultimately, I keep thinking that, right, this is the first night of the play, there's lots of time to work on it. I'm not sure that that's the attitude that you should take away from the first night of a play.
Can we talk a bit more about the performances? You mentioned Kevin Flood there. Did you like some of the other performances?
Oh, yes, I thought they were splendid. I thought Helen Ryan gave a splendidly controlled performance. The young actor who played Rabe, I thought Tom Radcliffe, again, in a part which was very difficult because it seemed to me that his character lacked coherence. Nevertheless, this was a young man of enormous talent. The girls were good. Julian Curry playing the actor manager, I thought, got everything that a second rate actor manager could be, and was very touching because his aspirations were so much at variance with his talent. I would have no complaint with any of the performances at all. I would have no complaint with the production, which I thought did everything it could with the play. And I keep coming back to the play. It had so much in it that was good. It has so many ideas that I would like to see more fully developed, but they haven't been developed in this play.
John Keyes there, talking to Dhiren Ivrian in Derry's Guildhall last night. I don't think it was the audience so much who were caught in the time warp of the 1980s, more like John and Dhiren. The Madam Macadam Travelling Theatre will be touring the country over the next few weeks before coming to Dublin for the theatre festival.
Don't you? The things...